arose and came to his father, but when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion on and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put on a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For the son was dead and is now alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to be merry. Now the older son was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house. He heard music and dancing. So he called one of his servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, Your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf. But he was angry and would not go in. Therefore the father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, Lo, these many years I have been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him? And he said to him, Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to see everyone here this morning, especially Kevin and Marilyn and Nathan, visitors from out of town. Before we get started in the lesson today, I want to correct something. In the announcements in the bulletin, you probably noticed a reference to a Dolores Groves. We don't have a member here named Dolores. And I don't know why, but ever since Darlene joined our number, I've always wanted to call her Dolores. And it extends even to putting notes in the bulletin. I call her Dolores. And I've racked my brain. Was there some old girlfriend somewhere? You know, a pair of twins I knew in elementary school? I don't know where this came from. But I apologize publicly to Darlene, even though she's not here this morning, or Dolores, or whatever her name is. This morning, we're going to be looking at this well-known parable in Luke chapter 15 that Brian read. It's a little longer reading than what we customarily do, but I think it was important to have that reading in order to establish the setting for our lesson this morning. Of course, we're familiar, I think most of us, with the story of the prodigal son, and it is a beautiful lesson on the general subject of sin and repentance, and especially the grace of God. The father in this parable represents a kind, compassionate, merciful God who's willing to go the extra mile to receive back the penitent child who has gone astray. And so much has been said and written about the parable of the prodigal son. In fact, here a year or two ago, I had a whole series on this parable. But there is one aspect of this parable that I feel like, in looking at the grander, more lofty lessons from this parable, that we fail to recognize. And that is that we are looking at a family that's falling apart. And that ought to immediately strike a nerve with us today in our society, right? One source that I read suggested that as many as 60% or more of families in America today are what sociologists would call dysfunctional. Dysfunctional families are defined as those families that have a very unhealthy degree or measure of conflict within them. Now, no family is perfect, okay? Especially if you have little kids. I understand there's going to be some measure of screaming and yelling going on. That just comes with the territory. What I'm talking about here is especially as those children grow older, as the husband and wife grow older in their relationship with one another, there is a very negative, toxic level of conflict, hostility, of tension in the relationships, either between the husband and wife or between the parents and the children, and especially as the children grow older, teenage and above. There can be some unresolved differences between those generations that just create a great deal of heartache and tension and hostility in the family. There can be problems between the siblings against one another. And you see elements of all of that really here in the parable of the prodigal son. And what we're going to do today is take a fresh look at this parable and try to make application to the problem that our society is currently struggling with regarding dysfunctional families. And let me just make a personal appeal here. If you look at your own family relationships, between generations, with siblings, whatever, look at your own family, and if you have been bothered over the years by the presence of a bad level of dysfunction in your family, I want you to pay careful attention to this lesson this morning. Because I think that the story here just sheds so much light on two factors that are really going to form the focus of our study. Number one, why do families fall apart? Why is it that these levels of hostility enter into a relationship and make those relationships so toxic? And number two, how are they fixed? Is there any possible way to heal a family that has been broken, has been dealing for years, for generations, with this level of dysfunction? Is it possible to heal those families? I think it is. And this little parable gives us some insights on how to do that. So let's start, number one, by looking at the idea of why families fall apart as seen in this parable. I think when we look at the two sons in this parable, the younger son and his behavior, the older son and his behavior, it's very obvious to see that pride is at work here, is it not? Pride can be defined as an inflated view of one's own importance. In Proverbs 21 in verse 4, Solomon writes, "A proud and haughty man, scoffer is his name. He acts with arrogant pride." And you see that arrogant pride in both of these sons. You have the younger son who is what we will call the out-of-control rebel. He decides that he's just going to do his own thing. No one is going to tell him what to do. In fact, the statement that he makes to his father pretty much typifies his whole attitude toward life in general. Give me that part of the inheritance which falls to me. And so his whole life is geared around what comes to him. And then we also have the older son, though, that when his younger brother comes back and seeks to be restored, the older son recoils in horror at the idea of allowing this younger brat brother of his back in the family. And so I call this guy the insufferable holier-than-thou snob. He's too good to associate with his younger brother who has brought such a stain of reproach upon the family name. Pride, of course, is one of those things, as either way that it manifests itself, as we've seen in these two sons, it always produces misery. In any kind of relationship, whether we're talking about a family or in a workplace or between neighbors, whatever, any kind of relationship in which pride inserts itself, it's always going to produce misery. In Proverbs 13 in verse 10, "By pride comes nothing but strife, but with the well-advised is wisdom." Proverbs 28 verse 25, "He who is of a proud heart stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the Lord will be prospered." In 2 Timothy 3, in verse 2, the first few verses of that chapter, Paul is describing perilous times that are going to come. And he identifies them later on as even occurring right in the lifetime of himself and his young friend Timothy. But he says one of the characteristics of these perilous times is that men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, and then a long list of these bad behaviors. All of which oftentimes find or are manifested in dysfunctional families. And here we see in these two sons, in this family, exactly two different kinds of pride that yet contribute to the breakdown of this family. One is the rebel, who's not going to let anybody tell him what to do. He's going to chart his own course, thank you. He just has an in-your-face attitude regarding flouting the rules. And he lived that way. And his family paid a price for that. The father's name was besmirched. His reputation, his finances were damaged pretty severely because of the out-of-control rebellion of this younger son. And the older son, just at the moment when it looks like this family's coming back together again, they're going to be healed, it's the older son that steps in, and he's too proud to allow his younger brother back. Do you remember the statement in verse 29? How the older son said, "Lo, all these years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your commandments. Give me a break." Now, I don't care how goody-two-shoes you are, none of us can honestly say that throughout our whole childhood and even into our adult years, we never disobeyed a command of our parents. This guy was just full of himself. It was pride of a different nature than what his younger brother did, but it was still pride. He was stuck on himself and his goodness, and that, he thought, put him several steps above his brother. And for that reason, he could not bring himself to embrace his little brother back into the family again. So just at the moment, it seems that the family's going to be restored, another brother steps in and his pride breaks it up again. So you've got pride of two different fashions coming together to create a family that is breaking apart. At the heart of every dysfunctional family is at least one person, and oftentimes more than one, whose egos overwhelm their better judgment. And they end up doing stupid things like this. Proud rebels and proud snobs cannot stand each other, and when you've got both of them in the same family, you've got a recipe for disaster. And that's why families break up. Problem is that everyone in the family looks around them at the other people in the family. That person's wrong. This person did it not right. This person has issues they need to deal with. And so everybody's pointing fingers at everybody else. And nobody's taking ownership of the problem. Whatever it might be, whatever the issues are, really isn't important, is it? It's the pride in the hearts of the family members that tear up families. You can put 100 families out here, every one of which has some degree of dysfunction, disorder, conflict, hostility, toxic relations, whatever you want to call it. Put 100 families out there and go in and examine every one of them, and the issues are just all over the map. Money, sex, kids, school, job, friends, it just doesn't matter. I mean, there's going to be all kinds of different things that will be churning within these families. But if you strip away all the junk and look inside the hearts of the people involved, it all comes back to pride. Either rebellious pride or snobbish pride, but it's pride. People are stuck on themselves. They're more concerned about themselves and their selfish interests than they are the interests of the other people in the family. And that will always result in family dysfunction. Mark it down. Look at your own family. Most of us can probably look, if not in our immediate family, we can see aunts, uncles, cousins, other people in the extended family somewhere where we see elements of this kind of pride at work. It's never pretty, it's never fun to deal with, but it's there and it's very real. But now let's turn our attention to how then, if this is the cause of families breaking apart, becoming toxic, how can it be healed? How can we take a family that is suffering from this kind of problem and put it back together again? How can we heal broken families? Well, if the root problem, as we've identified, is pride, what's the opposite of pride? It's humility, right? So if we can Inject humility into the family. Get people to understand the importance of being humble in their relationship towards one another. Then certainly that would take care of the problem. And in fact, you can make a scriptural case for this. Look in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind. Let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Now, can you give me a better prescription for solving family dysfunction than that verse right there? Let each look at others with lowliness of mind, seeing others as better than themselves. If everybody in a family treated each other that way, what would the family look like? If spouses had that kind of attitude toward each other, what would their marriage look like? If both parents and children had this kind of attitude toward each other, what would that cross-generational relationship look like? If siblings who got crossways with each other in their childhood and stayed opposed to each other as they grew up into adulthood, if they could adopt that mindset toward each other, do you think their relationship could be healed? I think so. Humility, rooting out the pride, and treating others as more important than oneself with lowliness of mind, that is the solution to a dysfunctional family. Humility is so critical to healthy relationships of every kind. Look in Titus chapter 3 and verse 2. Paul says that God's people are to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. Did you notice two words that are linked in that verse? Peace and humility. They always go together. When you've got people that have learned how to be humble toward one another, they're going to have a peaceful relationship with each other. 1 Peter 5 and verse 5, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 25, and this is a context in which Paul is advising Timothy on how to deal with people that we disagree with. He's talking, I think, in the context about the role of evangelism, but it also applies in a broken relationship within a family. How can we, if we recognize there's a problem on the part of the other person, and we just talked about that a moment ago, didn't we? That we recognize other people around us have their issues. Paul's addressing that here, and here's the advice he gives Timothy, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance. Let's just accept the possibility, in fact, the reality, that other people have other issues. Paul says, yeah, they need to be corrected, but do it with humility. Do it with humility. That's the problem, though, is when we try to help others in our family, we don't do it with humility. We do it with the older brother mentality. The snobbishness, the arrogance, the condescending attitude. I've got it figured out and you don't. That's never going to help. So even in those cases where, yeah, somebody else in the family needs to get things squared away, it's my job, it's the job of each one of us in the family to make sure we approach that with healthy doses of humility. And so notice how humility plays out in the story. Now, obviously, you're already thinking ahead of me, I'm sure. Humility is really seen in the course of action taken by the younger son, the rebel. The kid who thought he had life all figured out. He didn't need any help from his dad, his older brother, or anybody else. Give me what is mine, and I'm going to go out and do my own thing. And he did it, and it blew up in his face. Surprise, surprise. So he learned the hard way that being a self-centered jerk just doesn't work. It's not very healthy on multiple levels, right? And what just makes gives our heart warm fuzzies every time we read it is the story of how this young man came to his senses, came to himself, and realized what an idiot he had been. And so he said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to my father, and I'm going to tell him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to call your son. Make me as one of your hired servants. There is not an ounce of pride in any of that. Can you imagine the courage it took for that young man to do what he did? How many times in our own lives, and just forget about the family relationship, in any time in our lives, when we say or do something kind of dumb, we tend to want to excuse it, shift the blame to somebody else. Well, if they hadn't have done this or that, then I wouldn't have done it. Well, this young man doesn't do any of that. He just owns up to the fact that he blew it. It's all on him. And he's willing to go back to his father, swallow his pride, confess his sin to his father, apologize to his father, and ask to be put at the bottom of the ladder so that he can work his way back up. It took a tremendous amount of courage for that young man to do what he did. But what we have is an example of humility, right? And that's what it takes for any sinner to come back to God. And that's what it takes for any family member to get reconciled to the other folks in the family, the rebel especially. If you examine your own life and your relationship with the other people in your family, and you recognize, you know, I have said and done some pretty stupid things in my relationship, go to the other people in your family and beg their forgiveness. Apologize. Say, I'm wrong. I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have said it. I was out of line. No strings attached apology. You see, this is what's so difficult about this. We look at that young man and it just makes us feel so good to see somebody really clear the air like that and do what it takes to get everything put back together again. We admire it in somebody else, but we cannot bring ourselves to do it in a situation that oftentimes involves much less of apology than what this young man had to do. Pride. We cannot give up our pride. When we do something dumb, folks, in our families especially, we have got to learn how to just say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. There's no excuses for this. I'm not going to blame anybody else for this. It's on me. I'm sorry. I beg your forgiveness. And folks, if we could just learn, as husbands and wives, parents and children, siblings, to do that, it would just cure so much of the family dysfunction that is tearing our society apart. Now then, let's turn our attention now to one individual in this family that we've not talked much about, and that is the father. What good would it have done for this young man to come back to his father? He has a speech all prepared, and he has eaten a healthy serving of humble pie, and he knows what he has to do to make this thing right. He goes back to his father, and his father steps back, crosses his arms, says, how can I trust you? You realize what you've done to this family? I'm not sure I can take you back after what you've done. And you can fill out the rest of the script. I mean, you've probably seen this in families yourself, haven't you? Where somebody is trying to make things right, and the person on the other end, the one that we'll call the victim, refuses to accept the apology. Or requires the person coming back grovel, or jump through hoops, or do something in order to pay back the damage that has been done. What I'm trying to point out here is that here we have a father, a victim in this case. Again, he's been damaged by what his younger son did. But he's quick to forgive. He's not going to rub this young man's mistake in his face. He's not going to make him eat it. Instead, the father is going to absorb the cost himself. Now, folks, I know we use this all the time to talk about God and how wonderful His grace is, but don't you get it? God is giving us an example. Here's how I want you to act when somebody does you wrong. And especially if they come back to you with a heartfelt apology, you had better be willing to forgive. And do you know what the word forgive means? It means to release the debt. This person doesn't owe me anything anymore. I'm not going to hold something against this person who has come to me to apologize. So much of the family dysfunction that we deal with is because not just somebody that's not willing to come and apologize, but even when they do, the person on the other end is not willing to forgive. How foolish is that? We have a golden opportunity placed right in our laps to bury this thing, get it behind us, restore the relationship to what we all want it to be, and we cannot find it in our heart to forgive. And what's the problem? Pride. We're too proud to forgive. But not this father. He recognizes that what a painful trek this young man has made to come back to him to ask for this forgiveness, and he is more than willing to give it. He throws a party. Let's kill the fatted calf. He puts the robe on the son, ring on his hand. The family is back together again. It's no longer dysfunctional anymore, is it not? Except that we have one other party in this family who's not going to come on board. And that, of course, is the older son. This parable ends with this older son on the outside. He refuses to participate in the celebration. Now, you would say, well, he needs to admit his mistake and apologize, right? I mean, this is what we've seen already. This is how humility would help bring everything together. Could this older son have come into the party and looked at his younger son and said, "Brother, I misjudged you. I didn't agree with what you did, but the fact that you have come back into this family shows a degree of courage and contrition that I can scarcely imagine, and I appreciate what you have done, and I apologize for misjudging you." But that's not what we read, is it? The older son digs in his heels on the outside of the house. He refuses to acknowledge the young man's arrival, and he refuses even to accept his dad's plea to come in and join the celebration that his younger brother has come back. And let me just emphasize something here. The parable ends without reconciliation. It is still a dysfunctional family. Not the same kind of dysfunction that it was before, but it's still dysfunctional. But it has been my observation through the years that it is often the sanctimonious ones who keep the dysfunction churning. Did you hear what I said? It's the sanctimonious ones. The ones who think they've got it all figured out. They think, "I'm the victim. And I'm better than this other person." They are the ones who often keep the dysfunction churning within the family. It is very hard, also hard, for the rebel to apologize for the mistakes that he has made. But it is so much harder for the self-righteous to show mercy. Now, folks, that ought to speak to every one of us. And I say that as an older brother myself. I have seen this so often in my own life. I see it in the lives of so many other people. They cannot forgive. They cannot accept the apologies that come their way, because they're too good for it. And the result is families that remain dysfunctional. father in this story is the real hero. He's the one that was victimized. He was hurt deeply by what the younger son did. But he was willing to forgive when the younger son came back and tried to make it right. And even when his older son refused to come in, he pleaded with him. He went out of the house, out of the party, out of the celebration, and went to his older son and pleaded with him. This brother of yours was lost and is found. He was dead and is now alive. We have reason to rejoice. He extends mercy even to his older son, the self-righteous snob. But the older son just can't see it. He cannot see it. And the story closes with the family still dysfunctional. And so the question then becomes, when you have a dysfunctional family, and we see what is necessary in order to restore it, humility, the question becomes, who makes the first move? Who makes the first move? Of course, you know what the answer usually is. Well, when they make the first move, when they take the appropriate steps to patch it up with me, then I'll respond. I'll do the right thing. But they have to make the first move. Folks, take a good hard look at this parable. Who made the first move here? The whole parable screams, somebody else has already made the first move for us. When Jesus came to this earth, how did he come? Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2 that he humbled himself and gave himself for us on the cross. There's the first move. If you're in a family that's broken and twisted with hate and anger and conflict and pride, I invite you to stop. Instead of looking at the other people in your family, stop and look at what God, at what Jesus Christ has done for you. He has already made the first move. He gave himself for people who were too proud to make the first move in their own dysfunctional relationships. When spouses, parents, children, siblings recognize what Jesus did for them, it releases them to show the kind of humility that they need in order to repair the relationships. It frees them to make the apologies that need to be made. It frees them to extend the forgiveness that needs to be extended. Broken families can be healed again. The process starts, though, when we all turn our attention to the one who's made the first move in our behalf. Won't you accept what the Lord has done for you today? We can help you in any way do that. Won't you come and express your need as we stand and sing the invitation song?